You are now listening to episode 26 of In Part 2.
Ursula, you worked on the project Forest Law with Paulo Tavares, which draws from research carried out by you both in the oil and mining frontier in the Ecuadorian Amazon. What does the project encompass?
That's right, Deborah. It's a collaborative project, as you say. It's an art and research project on the cosmopolitics of Amazonia. And Ecuador, of course, was very interesting for us because it's the country that already has rights of nature inscribed in their constitution, as TJ explained. For instance, here that, you know, the rivers, trees, lagunas and forests actually have the right to evolve and reproduce themselves without hindrance. You know, they have really these innovative laws. And Ecuador was also interesting because it really is the center for worldwide NGO work, activism for the rights of nature. Kind of a hotspot. A lot of big NGOs are there. So we thought it would be interesting to look into three different juridical cases in which the forest is the main protagonist, to see how these new laws kind of pan out, right? So we are speaking really about one of the most biodiverse regions on Earth. And if in large areas the forest is still in good health there, it's because the indigenous nations who live in these forests have taken good care of it. But the state of Ecuador has licensed large areas to foreign investors to extract oil, minerals, copper, gold, etc. And so we ended up, they ended up with very conflictual kind of geography. So at the heart of forest law is the case of Sarayaku, a people who owns a large forest territory that is not very accessible. Sarayaku sued the state of Ecuador at the Inter-American Court of Human Rights in Costa Rica for licensing their land for oil exploration. Well, it would have been totally destroyed. They struggled. They mm-hmm. you know, after 10 years of struggle, actually, they won the case. And the oil company had to withdraw from their territory. And several ministers even came to their village, to the rainforest, to present their apologies. So I mentioned cosmopolitics because really here it's not just about global politics of resources. It's also about the cosmovision of the Amerindians, who respect nature and the earth as living beings with rights and acting powers. They respect nature because they know it's their livelihood as well, you know.
Yeah.
So there are indigenous leaders and activists speaking in the video, but it's also speculates also about the role of the Amazonian rainforest in the world climate and about the universal rights of nature as a common good. So in many ways, the video project is more visionary than purely documentary.
Yeah. And you have, and some of these indigenous leaders make appearances in the video.
They do, yes. Leaders and activists and shamans and botanists, various people speak in the video.
And I believe indigenous environmental lawyers as well.
There is a constitutional lawyer, a woman who also helped installing this. A constitution, writing it up actually together with some other lawyers in 2008 when they had this new constitution. Yeah. So she's speaking as well.
You're from Switzerland. How did you end up in Ecuador working on the project?
Yeah. Well, my artistic practice has always taken me to faraway places, you know. Mm-hmm. We work on geopolitical issues of migration or resources and other places. So I met Paulo, you know, he's a Brazilian architect. I met him through the collective project World of Matter, where we are both part of.
Yeah.
And Paulo and I had an ongoing conversation about non-human rights and common interest in a book called The Natural Contract by French philosopher Michel Serres, who kind of predicted these problems and pointed out how important it would be to, in addition to the social contracts that make up our legal system, to also include a natural contract. So that was totally inspiring for us. And when I got an invitation by the Broad Art Museum in Michigan to produce a new work, I immediately called Paolo to see if he would be interested in going on a field trip to Ecuador with me.
And you both have different backgrounds, right? You are an artist and you also have a curatorial practice. Pablo is an architect. How did each of your backgrounds influence how the project, the process of the project, and then also the sort of manifestation of it as well?
Well, Paolo was based in Quito at the time and was working on his PhD on the forest, not only in Ecuador, but also in Brazil and Peru, possibly. So he brought in a huge amount of knowledge about the history, about the colonial history, the indigenous struggle, the contemporary history. And, you know, he just knows so much about this whole area. But he also has a spatial practice as an architect. So he was very interested in going to these areas. And what he did mainly was drawing up a bunch of maps where that were illustrating or kind of rendering the juridical problems on the ground. In addition, he wrote the text for the book that we published on forest law. So, and I was working mostly on the video, and I think for me it was fantastic to work with someone who was knowledgeable and theoretically so astute. And for him, I think it was interesting to be with someone who is visually, has visual experience in how to put such a complex mass of information into coherent works, you know?
Yeah. Dane, you're working as the director of a marine lab and fish sanctuary project here in Jamaica. And as we all here know, the importance of the world's oceans and seas is coming into sharp relief right now. Unfortunately, it has taken catastrophes such as these deadly floodings, 5+ category hurricanes, melting ice shelves, etc., for us to really start heeding or fully realizing the importance of the world's oceans and, of course, to the Caribbean. Human relationships to the seas is more imminent here because we are island nations. What are some of the objectives of your work, and how does your work relate to climate change?
Thank you, Deborah. Thank you for having me on this panel. I feel a bit lonely being the only non-artist on this panel, but I'll try to make a positive contribution to the discussion. Just a bit of a context. Jamaica, as well as many small island developing states, it's a situation of out of sight, out of mind. They're not seeing the effects firsthand of the degrading coral reefs. They're not seeing the pollution on the water firsthand either. But many of us, there's a big lack of swimming ability. There's a big lack of snorkeling ability. And not to mention scuba diving as a cultural deficit in Jamaica and the rest of the Caribbean. There's also a belief that the ocean and the sea cleans itself and can deal with all the pollution that is thrown at it. It will just absorb everything and everything will be perfectly fine. And there's also a lack of connection with the land and the sea. You know, persons don't realize that what they do on land and all the way up in they don't really see that link. Mm-hmm. There's also a belief that there's a never-ending fish stock, that the fish will just always be coming and coming from wherever it's supposed to be coming from. You know, it's a little bit different from looking on a terrestrial environment where you can see the areas and the kind of defined boundaries of trees and crops and all these things. But with fish stocks, they figure that it will be coming from somewhere. You know, they can't really see the end of it. And another part of the context is persons feel that all fish belong to everyone, and to be able to do what they would like to do with the fish. No one really thinks about what would a fish like to do, and the life cycles of the fish and all of these other things. So that's the context of the Caribbean, and that has really helped us to not appreciate the position that we're in now with climate change until hurricanes after hurricanes keep hitting us right after the other, and unprecedented frequency and intensities. And of course, you're seeing the damage now. That's when they start noticing. Bringing it back to, you know, some of the objectives of the work that we do at Alligator Head Foundation in Jamaica, our main goal is to restore fish stocks. And we do that by removing or managing threats, as well as improving the marine environment. So that's our major objective. We do that through habitat restoration, for example. So we try to restore degraded mangrove areas, degraded seagrass areas, and of course, degraded coral reefs. I mean, we literally take small bits of coral, which are quite alive, and that's what grows the reef. We take these small bits of coral and we grow them on a nursery. Similar to a plant nursery, we take small plants. We take small corals, we grow them to a particular size, we clean them, we tend for them, make sure they're happy all throughout that period of time that they're growing. When it gets to a certain point, we put them back out on the natural reef. And that's helping nature to do what it's supposed to be doing. What we're trying to do is to realize that we have impacted the natural environment to regenerate. And we are trying to make sure we can restore as much as we can, you know, give it a fighting chance. Removing threats such as pollution, removing threats from garbage pollution, from sedimentation, from a wide range of threats that will have an impact, a negative impact on the marine environment. We try to address those. So figuring where the problem is and then figuring the solutions out. That's mainly all the things that we do. We have to work with the community as well, so developing alternative livelihood projects, because we mostly work in fishing communities. Now, we've established a fish sanctuary, which means no fishing in this particular area. You can't take any fish out. You can't take anything out of these fish sanctuaries. And these are persons that have been fishermen for generations. Now, the conversation started years before we even established the sanctuary with the fishermen. They complained, you know, the fishing is getting bad. The fish is declining. You know, what can we do about it? I say, you know what? One of the ways to do it is to actually have conservation areas or regeneration areas to be set up, which means you can't be taken out from these areas. So they understand that. But still, you have to develop these alternative livelihoods. You have to, you know, improve their skills, improve their marketability to do other things, develop different fishing areas which they can go to reasonably. Some persons, of course, you have to also put programs in to give them an opportunity to improve their livelihoods, whether it's making more money from a small restaurant that they have in town, mm-hmm. making money from a small hotel, or a small villa, or a small resident that they will rent out to persons coming down for the weekend in this tourist area. We also do marine education programs. He's talking about not just for the fishermen and their families, but also for these kids in school, because that's so important, because their point of perspective is very, very different from what our perspective as adults are. You know, we saw the decline. Their point of reference is, this is as big as a fish get. You know, you're seeing these small fish around and they think that's as big as it gets. No, but 20 years ago, before they were even born, the fish were much bigger. You know, they were a lot more plentiful. So changing that mindset and putting a positive spin on it in terms of what we can do as a nation to improve that. With respect to climate change, you know, the increased resilience of ecosystems improves the adaptation to climate change. So, and also the tenacity to bounce back after storms. You know, they can withstand a certain amount of pressure, but they're able to regenerate after the storm has passed, for example. So in a nutshell, that's pretty much what our work here in Jamaica and in Portland is about.
So you'd say then that the work that you're doing with the coral reef is work that then would have the ecosystem, the marine ecosystem, more resilient to these kinds of climate events that we had in 2017.
Right, that is correct. I mean, islands are protected by coral reefs. And you see that in Jamaica, you see it on mainlands as well. The coral reefs protect us from these storms. They protect us from wave energy. They protect us from these storm surges that will be coming on to impact our coastline. The majority of populations around the coastline in Ireland is quite significant. You know, most persons live around the coastline. The trade is conducted there. Persons live there. The road network and infrastructure is mainly around the coastline because most of our islands in the Caribbean are very mountainous. So you find the capital cities of these islands predominantly at the coastline. That's where the major ports are. So, you know, the coral reefs are protecting not just, you know, not just the biodiversity, but human way of life. And, you know, that kind of link between environment and the ocean is actually protecting us. That message needs to be clear, not just to the normal person in the street, but also the policymakers that sign on to these conventions.
Yeah.
And put laws in place.
And you mentioned alternative livelihoods for people who would be fishermen, and you had mentioned tourists, and I think this is a good point for me to ask Marina about her work. She was recently, Marina, I just met you recently in Jamaica. You were traveling around the Caribbean between several countries, doing research on the visitor economy. It sounds pretty self-evident what this means, but could you give us an introduction on what you mean by the visitor economy, what that means, and why you think it's important to study?
Yes. Well, for some context, we met in Jamaica, but I've also been traveling around the region. I went to Trinidad first, and then Panama, the Bahamas, Jamaica, and I've already been to the Dominican Republic, but I'm going back in a couple of days. So, and my interest in the cultural repercussions of tourism in the Caribbean stem from my own experience of moving back to Puerto Rico. I lived for close to 7 years in Argentina, and when I went back to, and I didn't go back as I didn't go back every year to Puerto Rico because it was so expensive. So when I moved back to Puerto Rico in 2014, I was a little bit shocked. I grew up in Old San Juan, which is also where Beta Local is, and I was living there and also working in Old San Juan. And I was actually like very, very annoyed. I was kind of angry at what I saw, just the transformation, the physical transformation of the space, the people, the influx of like these massive cruise ships. You know, maybe sometimes you could have from 19,000 to 30,000 people a day that would condition the kind of businesses and that could be possible there. So it would become kind of a, you know, plein air Airbnb instead of a community, the community that I grew up in. So my original interest in these subjects and what comes out of that is because of my own anger at what I was seeing. And that's when I encountered the term, the visitor economy, and it was being pushed by a particular foundation in Puerto Rico. It's a think tank that's called the Foundation for Puerto Rico. And it was established by this guy called John Borshaw. And he had a medical supplies company up until a few years ago. He sold it for like $600 million. And then he started this foundation because he wanted to give something back to the people, is what he said. Puerto Rico has been if it's more than 10 years old, we can call it a depression. So Puerto Rico has been in depression for a long, long time. And that's because there were certain tax incentives that phased out in 2006. So actually our economic problems predate the 2008 crash. So tourism has been seen as this, you know, be-all, like the solution. And the way that the image of Puerto Rico has been constructed since the 50s in media and film and in campaigns, like tourism campaigns that are also catered to us, to ourselves, that tell us how to behave with the visitor, they kind of make us believe that tourism is more important, is an economic sector that is way more important than it really is. Right now, tourism is only 8% of our GDP, represents 8% of our GDP. So actually manufacturing is still the most important sector, but it's obviously declining because of these, like, of the phasing out of these tax incentives. Anyway, so the visitor economy itself is a term mostly used in British or Australian tourism sectors, which is something that I found very strange. Like, if you look it up online or you see any kind of publications about this, it's usually in British or Australian contexts. But the foundation has been really pushing for this, and what they do is that they pay for studies and come up with numbers and statistics to convince the government to implement certain public policies. Tax breaks for people that will move into the country. They're incentivizing billionaires, like American billionaires, to move in there. They want the service sector to be really to grow a lot. And mm-hmm. the service economy can mean, you know, anyone from a tax lawyer or an accountant to a waiter or someone that's doing someone's bed. So the visitor economy is actually, it denotes the economic activity, the goods consumed and the services rendered by people who visit a place. This kind of economy takes into account a wide variety of activity, from medical, educational, business, cultural, artistic events or artistic practice, even agricultural, ecological, religious tourism, sporting events, literary festivals, concerts, anything, as well as people who also own vacation homes or decide to retire there. Mm-hmm. And it ends up really permeating all aspects of life. And what it does is, like, everything is marketed and then catered to the visitor instead of thinking about the people who actually live there and making the place better for us that are still there. So instead of supporting art institutions to think about long-term sustainability of the artistic community, then spectacle is more important. Mm-hmm. And the arts are, you know, they may just make us a great destination. And there is a permanent performance of culture and nationality and authenticity that I find also very important. Yeah, well, I found that there are certain, like, common issues that different places are struggling with or finding ways to cope with. So sometimes it's not like, sometimes it doesn't apply to all, but it applies to two or three of the places that I've been thinking about and reading. So it's like, first of all, these governments want to diversify the economy and go beyond sun, sand, and sea. So there's a lot of information that is being broadcast about what the place is. So I guess that the appropriation and the reappropriation of visual material that has been produced over time to promote a place or to made to represent a place or a people, that is being used to subvert that meaning and kind of turn it into something else that really speaks to other realities that people are going through or that to convey. And there is something else that's like an analysis of past efforts to foster better regional collaboration and understanding within the Caribbean context. Because I guess that every time people talk about the Caribbean, we talk about what has been like our historical problems of being able to communicate with each other, how there are, we have at different moments belonged to other metropolis or still do. So there has been that divide, but there have been thinkers in the past that have created a theoretical framework to analyze this now and to rethink it and establish collaborations. And so there is a rejection of these cliche visions of the countries as paradise. Mm-hmm. And And a lot of artists use humor to poke holes in the in these visions that are being presented to the outside viewer. Mm-hmm. As well as I think like a genuine interest in indigenous craft work and emphasizing local knowledge above all, that as well.
How has the visitor economy morphed in Puerto Rico since the hurricanes?
Well, it has been a strange situation for me because I was in Trinidad when Irma happened, and then I was somewhere else. I was in India for a conference when Maria hit. So I wasn't even able to get back home for a while. And I didn't experience any of the initial problems and problems with communication. And because one of the things that happened was that people in the island didn't know what was going on, and everybody else that was outside had more information. So it was very strange to be a tourist back home, like when I went back home. And something that I read about between the hurricanes was that some people in Puerto Rico and in Foundation for Puerto Rico and in government were actually kind of happy that some of the islands were closed for business, because that would mean that Puerto Rico could receive more tourists. Puerto Rico could then market itself as a destination for European tourists. So I think that also just stresses the fact that we are always competing amongst each other, because to many tourists, it's just another island. There's not anything particular about it. It's just another beach. Even though the official narrative is that we're highlighting culture above the beach, it really ends up being the same thing. And it's just like something nice that they put in their proposals, but they're not really doing anything else. I think that in contrast to what Deborah said, in our case, the political situation and the discussions about it has only been exacerbated. The colonial relationship, the second class citizenship status, the fact that sometimes in essays that are published in American outlets or even or in local newspapers that are owned by the same family anyway, they discuss how we are American citizens, and that's how, you know, like we deserve to get the FEMA assistance or whatever. And that is just kind of heartbreaking as well in the context of all these other discussions about immigrants getting deported, you know, and us having to, like, kind of the indignity of just like saying we are citizens and we deserve this. It's just like we are people, and there's a lot of Caribbean people that are going to be deported from the US as well. So I think that this has opened a wider public discussion about what it means to be like such an unequal partner in this colonial relationship to the US, the exploitative, the racialized nature of the treatment that we've been getting. Mm-hmm. And I hope, I mean, within my bubble, which is, in some ways, it's also Pablo's bubble, within our bubble, these are things that we have been thinking for a long, long time. But just the fact that people are getting more indignant about it might be, you know, like what the good thing that comes out of this.
Yeah. Deborah, can you touch on this?
Yeah, just in listening to Marina, I was struck too with the whole, so there's this organization called the Florida Caribbean Cruise Association that sort of came into my line of vision after 1995 when we got hit by Lewis, and a large part of our hotel rooms were destroyed. And so, you know, there's always this push for tourism as the main source of the main driver of our economy. And there was a real push to get back online quickly. And, you know, you realize too that a lot of the smaller islands, you know, I would watch this association sort of make suggestions about how you'd want to build your town, how you'd want to build a giant port, how you might want to do different things that actually affect the actual ecology of the island and the land itself, right? That you'd have to make these sort of major shifts to build that could accommodate these cruise ships, where you'd have to maybe dredge into the ocean bed, the seabed, to make it deep enough. And you sort of question, you're like, wow, this is some sort of cruise ship organization who was like very nicely would say, well, if you don't do it, there are all these other islands who might be willing to, because you really are just a sort of another island. But then your government has to make the investment into building this. And so diverting funds that could be put into education and other sort of projects all get directed to the sort of tourism product, because this association would then redirect cruise ships somewhere else, therefore affecting the economy. And so there really is this sort of connection between this sort of tourism and visitor economy that also affects the landscape and the environment of a lot of these places. You know, what is a beach? How many jet skis can come? Where does the waste from cruise ships go? Who gets to do that sort of thing? So it almost seems like it's not connected, but that for especially smaller economies that maybe don't have mining and other sort of like resources, the tourism as a product also does have this negative impact, not even mentioning the waste.
Yeah. So we here in the Caribbean, the tense issue of reparations for the slave trade from colonial empires to previous colonies previous colonies that are now populated predominantly by the descendants of slaves has still not been resolved. And yet on top of this, we're now also beginning to grapple with this whole concept of climate debt, right? I'm thinking of climate debt also in relation to things like just the Industrial Revolution, but also, as you just touched on, Deborah and Marina, things like the cruise ship economy, etc. But TJ, before we get into a deeper conversation on climate debt, what is climate debt? Because you mentioned it in several of your publications.
Sure. Okay. Climate debt, it is a central element of the climate justice struggle, which is that we have to address the causes and the vulnerabilities and impacts of environmental transformation in a way that understands their geopolitical inequalities and address those inequalities within the framework of justice. So climate debt has two components, as far as I can see, in relationship to proposals for how to address climate change. One is adaptation debt, which means that compensation is owed to underdeveloped countries by developed countries for the damages of climate change that developed countries have caused historically, so that there's a debt owed to underdeveloped countries because they're feeling often the most negative effects of climate change, which they had very little involvement in producing. And then there's emissions debt, which is similar, where compensation is owed by developed countries for their fair share of the atmospheric space that underdeveloped countries can't use if climate change is to be stopped. So it's basically a way of recognizing the fact that the history of climate change is not simply a universal responsibility, but has been caused by specific countries, by specific industries within those countries, within the larger field of unfolding globalization that is far from equitable. So it's a demand. It's often made. It's a demand that one sees in the United Nations climate summits that have been going on for the last couple of decades. It's typically a demand made by underdeveloped countries or developing nations. And it's one that is resisted by developed countries. So the most recent COP23 that met in Bonn, Germany this last fall was pretty much removed the concept of climate debt from the table. So we could view this as a further act of injustice at that high transnational geopolitical level. I would also want to point out, and I'm sure that Pablo and Marina could speak to this as well, but I think we're actually operating in a world where it's really the reverse of the climate debt philosophy that is actually operating. So if you look at the context of Puerto Rico, And the recent hurricane season and the disasters that have befallen Puerto Rico, that, of course, is occurring within a long-standing condition of debt servitude, where Puerto Rico is basically having to service long-standing financial aid agreements from the U.S. and from creditors, financial institutions, and even vulture funds that are attempting to exploit the conditions of debt financing and international economic relations with Puerto Rico, even though Puerto Rico at the same time is part of the United States. So it's not that climate debt is anywhere near being internationally recognized and practiced. It's in fact rather the reverse, that the conditions of unequal debt servitude or even debt colonization continues to occur. And so it's very much working in the opposite way. I think there's also other ways of conceiving climate debt, which we could bring up in relationship to rights of nature discourse, which would be, you know, if rights of nature recognizes the legal subjectivity and agency of non-humans, what would the debt be that is owed to non-humans for the whole, you know, situation of climate change? What does human society, or what do the most, you know, the most culpable within human society, which I think is multinational fossil fuel-based corporations, what would they owe to the non-human world? And I think that it's a speculative question. It's not one that I don't know anyone who's addressing this, but I think it would be really interesting to think about, because of course we live in a context of mass species extinction event, where we're seeing the extinction of species at rates that are 1,000 times the historical average. And that's very much a result of human-caused or corporate capitalist fossil fuel caused climate transformation. But what would it be to think about, you know, debt in those terms? And also, if international governance is refusing to address the conditions of climate debt within climate change policy making and governance, how might those questions be taken up and investigated within the cultural sphere? I think we're seeing that more broadly and globally today, as we see the increased failure or corruption of electoral politics, as we're seeing government officials increasingly behave in ways that are beholden to corporate industry. We're seeing the failure of democracy, or a move toward illiberal, even authoritarian democracy. And if you consider the conditions of the states as an example, it's difficult to consider what Trump is doing to be any kind of example of democratic practice. But in the failure of democracy, I think people within the cultural sphere are increasingly asking these kind of questions, like what would it mean to develop democratic forums or legal proceedings or systems of justice and climate change solutions that don't necessarily fall within mainstream imperatives of advancing the goals of economic growth and accumulation. So I think climate debt is it's a crucial category, and we could really open it up in a range of ways.
Mm-hmm. Ursula, does the concept of climate debt figure at all into the work you did with the Forest Law project?
The fact that they are taking care of the rainforest, and we all know what an important role the rainforest plays in the global climate. You could say the indigenous people of Amazonia contribute to the mitigation of climate change, and hence we owe them something for their service, you know. In that sense, I think there's a debt towards those who render ecological services. And I think that in order to achieve the goals that were signed for Paris, a lot of countries are realizing now that it's not enough to reduce cars and so on. They also have to reforest in a big way. And I think a lot of countries have started to aggressively do reforesting in a lot of areas. And from what I understood, the European Union has also made available quite large sums to countries, you know, to help them adapt to the climate change. So I think it's not as black as TJ is describing it. I regularly read up on all these efforts that are being made. But I think myself, I couldn't add anything better to how TJ explained climate debt to.
I'm going to go to Dane because you just mentioned that the EU funding, and I guess one of the initiatives you might be talking about is the 5 C's. But Dane, what do you think about climate debt in relation to the issues we face with the coral reef in Jamaica and in relation to the current and future state of the Jamaican economy?
Well, speaking first about the Jamaican economy, you know, we have depended so much on our coastal resources. And of course, that's mainly linked to our natural resources along the coastline. Sorry. Now, you have a situation where you are so dependent on healthy coral reefs, healthy seagrass beds, areas, white sand beaches. That's one of your major pulls here in Jamaica for tourists, for them to come to Jamaica to spend quite a tidy sum to be here and to actually enjoy the resources. Now, all of these resources, and we're seeing it firsthand, the beaches are declining because of coastal erosion, and mainly it's due to these storms coming in, these high-intensity storms and high-frequency storms. We're seeing more active hurricane seasons now. So you have a situation where the beach doesn't get a chance to regenerate naturally. You are now also putting more pressure on these resources because you have to then balance out that economy. So when you're losing tourists because they're not coming because the beach is degraded, you know, oftentimes what happens is that they increase the pressure on the environment to make up the gap, whether they're increasing the number of hotel rooms, increasing the number of packages that they offer for cruise ships to come in. Mm-hmm. So all that is creating a greater strain on the natural environment. Now, a small country, a small developing country like Jamaica, as well as other Caribbean countries, are feeling the effects of climate change. And yes, we did not contribute significantly to these effects. So I totally understand with respect to, yes, it would be great, it would be wonderful if we could get something from developed countries. And we've heard about blue carbon, and we've heard about carbon credits in the past. But the implementation of these initiatives, we're not seeing it yet in Jamaica. You know, we're only seeing the concept from a conceptual standpoint. But I don't think it is really not taking traction here in Jamaica. We know how much it is to restore a reef system. Mm-hmm. We've calculated that so many times. We've done it, so we know the cost of it.
Yeah.
But those funds have to come from somewhere. And oftentimes it's competing with health and education and crime prevention. You know, those are the things that those funds are competing with. And it's very hard sometimes, even though tourism is bringing in a lot of money, it's very hard to get money from tourism for natural resource management. It's very hard because it's not a tangible where you can definitely see, okay, I'm going to spend $1 million to restore this reef system, and that will in turn give me a return on investment in 5 years' time of X amount. It's not as easy as that to calculate. And environmental economies, you know, they have all these projections, and many times these projections don't add up, they don't agree. So it's a very difficult argument to actually have.
Yeah.
But I can see the need for climate debt discussions and putting that into an implementation plan, and I definitely welcome it.
Mm-hmm.